and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a claim by WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who is holed up inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London, that his access to the internet has been, quote, intentionally severed by a state party. We will examine whether, in fact, that state party is Assange's host, President Correa of Ecuador, who is reported to have warned Assange not to dump John Podesta's hacked emails and is furious that Assange defied him. Carlos Loria, the Senior Americas Program Coordinator at the Committee to Protect Journalists, joins us to discuss the flood of conspiracy theories about Assange's predicament, many of which blame Secretary of State John Kerry, as well as the case of Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman, who was facing charges which were just dropped for practicing journalism at a Native American-led protest in North Dakota against an oil pipeline. Then we'll look into Donald Trump's persistent claims that the election will be rigged against him, repudiating his own vice president who promised to accept the results while calling GOP leaders so naive. An award-winning investigative journalist, political columnist, and foreign correspondent with The Guardian, The Independent, The Nation, and The Atlantic, Andrew Gumbel, the author of Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America, joins us to discuss Donald Trump's exhortation to his followers to act as vigilantes and go to polling places in certain neighborhoods to prevent a stolen election, and whether there will be violence and intimidation across America on November the 8th. Then finally, we will discuss the unusual succession underway in Thailand following the recent death of the king who ruled for 70 years, with Gerald Fry, Distinguished Professor of International and Intercultural Studies at the University of Minnesota and author of The Thais, The Bamboo and the Lotus, and A Historical Dictionary of Thailand. He joins us to discuss why the anointed successor, the Crown Prince, will wait a year before taking the throne and whether the reservations expressed by the late King's most trusted advisor that the Playboy Crown Prince who lives in Germany does not have the capabilities for the job are a factor. And joining us now is Carlos Loria, who's the Senior Americas Program Coordinator at the Committee to Protect Journalists, where he serves as Chief Strategist and Spokesperson on press freedom issues in the Americas. He monitors and documents press freedom violations in Latin America and has led missions to Mexico, Colombia, Guatemala, Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, Nicaragua, Haiti, Brazil, El Salvador, and Argentina. And he serves on the board of the Maria Moores Cabot Award for Excellence in Latin American Journalism, which is sponsored by Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carlos Loria.
How are you, Ian? It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, thank you, Carlos. And you're having a busy day fielding questions from across the Americas about the, wasn't so much an arrest of Amy Goodman, but she was had to face charges today in North Dakota. And I guess the good news is that the judge threw the charges out. But
that's really, it's a relief that the judge in North Dakota refused to authorize just ridiculous riot charges against Amy Goodman. I mean, we were dismayed earlier when we heard that the prosecutor has filed charges against her, and, she was doing her job, covering protests on an issue that, it's very sensitive. And, we said previously, a few weeks ago when she was charged with criminal trespassing that, the North Dakota prosecutors should be embarrassed of themselves and that charges should be dropped. So, hopefully this will, allow Amy Goodman to continue to do her work without any interference. That's what we hope.
Well, but do you see this, though, as an embarrassment to the United States? I mean, in the sense that your colleagues in Latin America are asking questions about this, and this is not something that normally would happen in the United States. It's almost as if the prosecutors in North Dakota just discovered that there was such a thing as the First Amendment.
I think I would agree with you, and that's what we said. I mean, it was an embarrassment, and And, you know, prosecutors in North Dakota should stop embarrassing themselves. You know, the charges were a clear attempt to intimidate Amy Goodman and reporters from covering protests of significant public interest. And, you know, again, instead of, you know, trying to stop them to cover, you know, authorities should ensure that all reporters are free to do their jobs. It's a really bad example for the rest of the world, no doubt about it.
And Amy Goodman, who had surrendered to authorities in North Dakota in response to the charge, went before District Judge John Grinsteiner, and he, of course, felt there was not sufficient evidence to support the charge of rioting or inciting a riot.
Ian, it was clear. There's videos showing that she's talking to people, that, you know, that she was filming. You know, that's clear evidence that she was doing her work. And as she said, this was not trespassing. This was not rioting. She was simply doing her job as a reporter. So, you know, this decision by the judge today, obviously, it's a relief. And obviously, we welcome this decision. And we hope that now, you know, she can continue her important work, her important reporting work.
And Amy Goodman made a statement today, quote, "This is a complete vindication of my rights as a journalist to cover the attack on the protesters and of the public's right to know what is happening with the Dakota Access Pipeline." So, but of course, earlier this month, a U.S. actress, Shailene Woodley, was arrested at the construction site of the North Dakota Access Pipeline. And what's the latest on her, do you know, the actress? Is she, did they drop the charges on her?
I really don't, have not followed her case. Right. You know, we are, as a Press Freedom Group, we are...
You're more focused on journalists, aren't
you? Yeah, we're strictly focused on journalists.
Sure, sure.
But it seems like, you know, a bad decision, and you know, hopefully, her case will also be dismissed.
Well, her arrest was captured on social media. It was live streamed. So, welcome to the age of social media.
Yeah, exactly.
Obviously, it had a major effect, particularly on the way that police shootings in this country have been covered. But again, I'm speaking with Carlos Loria, who is the Senior Americas Program Coordinator at the Committee to Protect Journalists, where he serves as Chief Strategist and Spokesperson on press freedom issues in the Americas. He monitors and documents press freedom violations in Latin America and has led missions to Mexico, Colombia, Guatemala, Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, Nicaragua, Haiti, Brazil, El Salvador, and Argentina, and serves on the board of the Maria Moores Cabot Award for Excellence in Latin American Journalism, which is sponsored by Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. So, given that we've talked before, Carlos, about freedom of the press in Venezuela, for example, that the government has basically closed down or bought out all of the opposition, just about all of the opposition newspapers and TV. So it's obviously an issue of concern in a number of Latin American countries, although there's been vast improvements over the last few decades. What is the attitude when your Latin American colleagues are calling you about this issue? Do they see any kind of double standards here or any hypocrisy from the country that, you know, always holds itself up as a sort of beacon of freedom?
Well, that's something interesting that you mentioned it. Ian, because obviously journalists in Latin America look at these issues, and any failure from the United States to uphold its own standards, may embolden autocratic leaderships around the world, with their policies towards media. And it's interesting that you bring this up because CPJ has always been concerned about the situation of press freedom around the world, and you know, sometimes citing the U.S. as an example. But you know, in the past, you know, since 9/11, we have seen deterioration of press freedom in the United States too. So you know, it is important for CPJ to highlight these problems here in this country. So you know, it's clear that we don't have a double standard, no?
Well, what does the journalists in Latin America, what do they think about Donald Trump and his relationship to journalism? Because it's kind of mixed. On the one hand, Donald Trump would not be the phenomenon that he has become and the standard bearer for the Republican Party, but for the fact that he was given so much free press by the media. And now, right. Now he's at war with the very same media that elevated him, because right. He thinks that it's rigged against him in favor of Hillary Clinton. So without putting words in your mouth, in many ways, you know, you could make a case that Donald Trump is a North American Caudillo.
Well, you know, the way that Donald Trump has treated the press since the beginning of his candidacy, you know, was insulting and vilifying the press, you know, it's also a matter of concern for journalists around the world. You know, he has, as you know, politicians, because he's not a leader, he's a candidate, right? But politicians in other parts of the world do act similarly as Trump. They usually ask him, have labeled the press as scum or dishonest, singled out individual news organizations and journalists. So it is concerning that for journalists here also, but for journalists, you know, around the world, that, you know, the effect that these his words and actions are taken can create an environment where, you know, attacking journalists can become a routine, no? So it is of concern to us, and, you know, this has been followed by the press internationally, and, you know, CPJ has taken note and has expressed concern about this.
Well, of course, in answering the stories that the New York Times broke about his taxes, Donald Trump's response was to blame a Mexican, Carlos Slim, who's a minority right. stakeholder right. in the New right. York Times. I mean, right. How did that play in Latin America?
Well, you know, there's such a, you know, there's so many things in the last few days. I was talking to a couple of Latin American correspondents today, and they have so many things to cover that, you know, this Slim accusation has not... play the, you know, something in particular, because, you know, they feel overwhelmed with the barrage of accusations of Trump's against the media and against, you know, the opposition. And so, you know, I think that, you know, many of the people covering this election are really, really, you know, they have their hands full. And you know, it's a barrage of statements, you know, by the hour, that makes it very difficult to digest everything he says.
Well, Carlos Loria, I know that the Committee to Protect Journalists don't have a statement yet on what's happening in London with Julian Assange, but in the broadest sense, it's pretty almost amusing in the way that. The fact that Julian Assange has said that his internet access has been, quote, intentionally severed by a state party. This has led to enormous speculation and conspiracy theories because this has fueled speculation that Julian Assange had died and that these dead men's keys or dead man's switch, these encryption codes of other secrets were supposed to be unveiled upon his desk. And apparently they're called pre-commitments. And apparently a number of these pre-commitments were published by WikiLeaks to suggest maybe that, particularly that Secretary of State John Kerry may be involved. And the other extraordinary thing is that just yesterday, the actress Pamela Anderson of Baywatch, she paid a visit to Julian Assange at the Ecuadorian embassy in London and brought him some sandwiches, which apparently were vegan sandwiches. And apparently she fed him these, she's concerned about his health and well-being, so she fed him these vegan sandwiches and vegan snacks. And apparently Julian Assange was apparently unimpressed with her choice of a meal and said, "I was tortured by her because she brought vegan food." But now the conspiracists online are saying that Pamela Anderson poisoned Julian Assange. So what do you make of this?
I mean, I really, you know, prefer to get into speculations and conspiracy theories. There have been many surrounding Julian Assange lately. So, I would prefer just not to get into this. There's a lot of speculation around it, and I'll wait and see to see what's the latest.
Well, exactly. I mean, we'll probably know something more in the next few days about who it is that Julian Assange was referring to, that, quote, that his internet access was, quote, intentionally severed by a state party. Roger Stone, who's a former advisor for Donald Trump, has said that John Kerry has threatened the Ecuadorian president with grave consequences for Ecuador if Assange is not silenced. Reports that the Brits stormed the Ecuadorian embassy tonight while Kerry demands the UK revert their diplomatic status so Assange can be seized. Mm-hmm. So that is obviously, Roger Stone, of course, is feeding in and feeding this atmosphere of conspiracy. So I take it in the next few days we will find out, although I'm told by reliable sources that, in fact, the state actor that cut the internet access was President Correa of Ecuador, who's furious with Julian Assange because he warned him not to release this John Podesta data dump to hurt Hillary Clinton, and Assange ignored him. So there's quite a lot swirling around here. But in general, what position does the Committee to Protect Journalists take vis-a-vis prominent whistleblowers like Julian Assange? Would your bias be in favor of the whistleblower as opposed to those that accuse
him? Well, we have said in our 2003 Obama report that the aggressive prosecution of whistleblowers was a problem, and especially it was a problem that could have consequences on the free flow of information, and we have taken a strong position on that, yes.
Well, it is a strange world we live in, Carlos, just in closing, because clearly, you know, the U.S. government is charging the Russian government with interfering in the elections and feeding damaging information to WikiLeaks. So at the end of the day, do you expect any clarity on what's going on behind the scenes in this election?
You know, there's a lot, you know, again, you know, there's a lot of things that we don't know about these charges and this conspiracy theories and speculation. I will insist on something. I think that, you know, the aggressive prosecutions of leakers of classified information and you know, broad electronic surveillance programs that turn government sources from speaking to journalists, and that is clearly a problem.
Well, Carlos Loria, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ian. Thanks for your attention.
And again, I've been speaking with Carlos Loria, who's a Senior Americas Program Coordinator at the Committee to Protect Journalists, where he serves as Chief Strategist and Spokesman on press freedom issues in the Americas. He monitors and documents press freedom violations in Latin America and has led missions to Mexico, Colombia, Guatemala, Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, Nicaragua, Haiti, Brazil, El Salvador, and Argentina, and serves on the board of the Maria Moores Cabot Award for Excellence in Latin American Journalism, which is sponsored by Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Donald Trump's persistent claims that the election will be rigged against him. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Andrew Gumbel, who has worked as an award-winning investigative reporter, a political columnist, and a foreign correspondent for The Guardian, The Independent, The Los Angeles Times, The Nation, and The Atlantic. He's the author of several books, including Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed, and Why It Still Matters. And his latest book is Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Gumbel.
It's a pleasure.
And Donald Trump is still insisting that the election will be rigged. Just on Monday, he tweeted, "Of course there is a large-scale voter fraud happening on and before Election Day. Why do Republican leaders deny what's going on? So naive." And then prior to that, after his own vice presidential candidate, Pence, Governor Pence, had in a televised address on Sunday assured the nation that he would accept the results in next month's election. Nevertheless, Donald Trump then tweeted, "Election is absolutely being rigged by the dishonest and distorted media pushing crooked Hillary, but also at many polling places. Sad." So here he is repudiating his own vice president, and then on Monday going on again with this persistent idea that the election is going to be rigged. Is there a strategy here, or is this some peculiar venting?
I think there's absolutely a strategy here, and I think you have to sort of split it up into its constituent parts a little bit. Part of it is fueling what, you know, others have called correctly, I think, the grievance industry, that I think that this is looking beyond the election to how Trump and his ilk are going to position themselves to mount whatever media enterprise they're planning on, and it's giving talking points to the base, the people who want to believe that everything's unfair, that the elites control everything, that nothing is ever going to change unless there's some kind of revolutionary movement. And this gives rhetorical, you know, grist to that mill. That's point number one. Point number two is this also fits in with a long Republican Party strategy for turning out their voters, turning out their base, and also to provide some necessary public doubt in the event of close races to give the energy needed to push to try and get over the line where it gets really close. So, you know, there's a widespread belief among bedrock Republicans that illegal immigrants frequently get on buses from Mexico, come in and vote illegally. They frequently believe that, you know, the dark days of Chicago are still with us and that there's routine voter fraud there and on and on. And there's an unmistakable racial patina to all of this. When they're talking about voters in Chicago, when they're talking about voters in Philadelphia, when they're talking about voters even in a place like Phoenix, they're not talking about white voters. They're talking about brown and black voters, and that is a very clear dog whistle that's being sounded by a party that increasingly can only count on white voters and needs to generate some kind of sense of grievance over that, too, to overcome the sort of inbuilt now demographic disadvantage. And then there's a third thing as well, which comes from history, which, you know, is a follow-on from the observation about the dog whistle, which is, you know, where does this come from? Where does this tradition come from in American politics to say the other side is cheating, we need to do something about it? And the answer is, you know, if you look back to the civil rights era, the Republican Party mounted something called Operation Eagle Eye. It was something that in Arizona was enthusiastically joined by future judge William Rehnquist. They would challenge voters at the polls. They would ask them about their knowledge of their constitution. They would challenge them on their knowledge of English if they were Latinos. And it was a deliberate vote suppressant mechanism. And I think that when Trump and his supporters talk about encouraging people to go to the polls and see if the other side are voting fairly or not, that is a callback to that very ugly historical tradition.
And of course, William Rehnquist ended up being in charge of the Supreme Court for quite some time.
And was also the one who determined Bush versus Gore in 2000. Absolutely.
But let's talk a little bit about what you just told us, Andrew Gumbel, in the context of charges, again, repeated often by Donald Trump, that this election will be stolen and that he has called upon his followers to act as vigilantes and go to polling places in what he calls certain neighborhoods, which is, I think, a dog whistle code, to prevent the election being stolen. Are we on a collision course then for a repeat of what happened in Arizona back in the 60s, early 60s, that you referred to with William Rehnquist? Could we have an updated version of that at various polling places around the country, particularly in minority communities, with heavily armed vigilantes, supporters of Donald Trump?
I think the risk is different. I think it's absolutely there. I think when you mention arms, I think that is a real concern, that people will show up with guns and that we could see actual violence. In terms of the psychology of it, I think we're in a very different space from where we were in 1962. And I think, you know, most voters will be able to show up at the polls. There will be poll watchers there. There will be hotlines for election protection teams with lawyers, if necessary, who can swoop in and sort out anything that happens inside polling stations. However, if people show up with guns and if they use those guns, all bets can be off. So I think, you know, it is on the one hand less concerning because of the political atmosphere and the institutions that exist, but also more concerning because I think the propensity for violence, in my judgment, is greater now than it has been since, you know, the hot moments of the civil rights era.
But in terms of incitement, Donald Trump just on Sunday blamed, quote, animals representing Hillary Clinton for some graffiti and an attack on a local Republican Party headquarters in Hillsborough, North Carolina. I mean, it's possible, but it also is equally possible, surely, that it's a kind of, you know, a petty example of the kind of Reichstag fire, you know, where the other side.
Right. I think anything is possible. And I think, you know, I think we do Donald Trump too much credit if we try and parse his words and say, what exactly is he referring to? What danger is he pointing out? Because, you know, my perception of his rhetoric at this point is he's spraying everything he can in all directions. Blaming the media, blaming election officials, blaming the Hillary Clinton campaign. And not only is there, you know, little or no evidence for anything he says, but I don't think he's actually interested in evidence for anything he says. So I think just sort of to parse it too carefully is a mistake. And probably what is more important is to look at incidents as they happen and look for evidence that there may be, you know, areas of concern so that law enforcement, lawyers, poll watchers and others can move in and do what they can to protect the integrity of the voting process. What I think a lot of organizations are planning on doing. And this is not a new thing. The level of the threat may be different, but for the last several election cycles, really ever since the showdown in 2000, we've seen, you know, talk, especially on the Republican side, but not exclusively, of going to the polls and making sure that the people on the other side are legit. And we've seen in response, you know, a large turnout of poll watchers and lawyers who have tried to take each potential problem in hand quickly so that it doesn't spiral out of control. So there is a structure there and a precedent for how to deal with this stuff, which is why, you know, absent the firearms, I'm not too concerned. Once people start shooting, it's a whole different thing, and that would be my number one concern. And, you know, presumably local law enforcement and others will be on hand to watch for any signs of that kind of violence breaking out.
So is there anything you can do, Andrew Gumble, to chip away at this kind of paranoid conspiracy theory belief system that's embedded in so many Republicans, that fraud is endemic in the country? The Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law did a recent report called The Truth About Voter Fraud, and they found that voter fraud incidents in this country rate between 0.00004% and 0.0009%, almost infinitesimal. I mean, first of all, it defies logic to be able to rig the vote in America in any comprehensive way, which is, I think, why I think Vladimir Putin's the idea that he may be able to swing the election is a little bit exaggerated, because there's so many, the states all have different systems, very few of which are vulnerable, but some of them are in Georgia and in Pennsylvania and Virginia, which are swing states, but by and large, they're not. But it's not just the states that control the elections, it's the municipalities. And there's something like 14,000 of them. So how in God's name could you have a coordinated vote rigging system in 14,000 different places at once?
Well, that's an excellent question. And again, I think we have to break it down into its constituent parts. You know, what the Brennan Center is referring to is in-person voter fraud. That's people showing up at the polls, casting ballots when they're not eligible to vote, casting ballots in places when they're not eligible to vote, and so on. And that is a passingly rare phenomenon. And a previous report of theirs said it was rarer than being struck by lightning. So, you know, the reason the Republican Party has played that up on the basis of zero evidence has been as an excuse to pass voter ID laws, which have a much more obvious effect, which is to suppress the votes of marginal, usually Democrat-leaning voters, and potentially swaying results by up to 2 or 3 percentage points, as a number of studies have pointed out. And we've seen a pushback from the courts against many of those laws in the last few months. So that's, you know, issue number one. But issue number two is that, you know, the United States does not have a rock-solid, dependable voting system. It just doesn't. And because of so many municipalities, the quality and the degree of the problems varies enormously from place to place. But, you know, there is a problem there, and it is fundamentally that the whole process is politicized. There is no independent body above the parties that sets standards, purchases voting equipment, sets out rules for counting, you know, for all these, you know, all the different constituent parts of what goes into election day processes. And almost every other advanced Western country does have those kinds of processes in place. So once you have, you know, reason to have worries, at least around the edges, it does give grist to this rhetorical mill that says the whole thing is corrupt and we shouldn't trust any of the results. But we have to be very careful to define what we mean. Usually when elections get played around with, first of all, it usually happens with very local races where people have an opportunity to make mischief and where the candidates are known personally to the county officials who are responsible for the count, and there may be some personal animus there. There have been a number of documented instances of that. Second time where it can be, you know, a problem is where the race gets very close, the stakes are high, and one party's in charge and has an opportunity to do mischief. You know, exhibit A of that is Florida in 2000, where, just to give one of many, many examples, and you know, after the vote was initially counted, the state ordered a statewide manual recount. And 18 counties that leaned Republican chose not to conduct that recount. Had they done so, they would have found enough votes for Al Gore to give him the election, but they secretly chose not to conduct those recounts and kept the results in George Bush's favor. So right there you have an example of vote rigging of the kind that is conceivable. What Trump is talking about, what, you know, we have read that the Russians may or may not want, is something that is indeed impossible, which is to manipulate results across, you know, all those municipalities, different states, different voting systems. That is not a doable thing. You know, if the Russians or anybody else wanted to make mischief, their best bet would be to find a corrupt local official in a place where they have electronic voting machines without a paper trail, get them to put them in touch with the voting machine company, somehow get a hold of the source code and play with that. so that, you know, the results, as they're being fed into the machine and spat out into the tabulation part of the machinery, is corrupted right there. You know, is that a likely thing? I've talked to many people who make it their business to worry about this. They all say it's possible. None of them say it's likely.
So what would you then consider to be the greatest threat to this election, notwithstanding Trump's persistent dog whistle, which I think is what it really is, that this election is going to be rigged? Is it? This will, of course, be the first election without the protection of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act.
That's correct. And, you know, there have been attempts to change the rules in the states that were previously covered by Section 5. In Georgia, there have been legal fights, in Alabama, elsewhere. You know, will this have an impact? Almost certainly. Will it change the results of the presidential race? You know, it depends whether Georgia comes into play at the end of the day or not. Will it affect other races down ballot? Absolutely. And that's something that's an abiding concern. You know, I would say that the biggest threat at this point is to the whole concept of the political fabric of this country. There was a consensus for a long time that this is an advanced democracy, that we do things a certain way. And even with all the flaws and the problems and the history of racial discrimination in certain parts of the country, you know, there was at least a cross-party consensus that, you know, we do things peaceably, we do things in a way that we recognize. When one party either accepts defeat in an election or is determined to have lost by the courts, then they hand over power gracefully to the people who won. All these things are now in question, and I think that is, you know, really dangerous. You know, if Donald Trump on November the 9th wakes up having lost the election according to the returns and decides he's going to refuse to concede and then calls on his supporters to take to the streets and rise up in revolt, you know, we have a serious not only civil order problem for November 9th on our hands, but we also have serious questions about how to put the genie back in the bottle and get back to a orderly democratic political system. I think that's a really deep concern and something that causes me to lose sleep, and I think a lot of other people too.
Well, do you think, though, Andrew Gumbel, that that attitude or that consensus, that bipartisan consensus about accepting the results, because that's the whole point of elections, that distinguish democracies from, you know, banana republics, is that the loser is satisfied with the results. And if it seems to me that Florida 2000 changed that.
What Florida in 2000 changed was the gentleman's agreement between the parties that once the results come out, you know, you don't contest it, you don't allege any kind of manipulation, you just gracefully lick your wounds, go away, and try again next time. Florida 2000 changed that for sure. But even then, you saw Al Gore, once the Supreme Court ruled, saying, I disagree with the ruling, but I'm conceding gracefully. You know, there was never any question about contesting the result beyond the ultimate legal opinion. Now I think we have to worry that that's no longer the case. You know, I would also say, you know, this is a country that puts a lot of stock in winning. You see that in sports, and I think it's true for politics, too. I think if Hillary Clinton wins by a very large margin indeed, you know, my prediction is that any, you know, subsequent allegations of a rigged election or an unfair result are not going to have a great deal of traction. However, if in a number of key swing states or even overall the race is very close and people have some legitimate questions about the accuracy of the count in certain places because the machines aren't entirely reliable or for any other reason, then I think that, you know, becomes a much more dangerous situation in which Trump and his surrogates saying inflammatory things is likely to have a much greater impact. So again, more reasons to lose sleep.
Well, speaking of Trump surrogates, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani told CNN over the weekend that you'd have to be a moron to think that some elections such as those in Philadelphia and Chicago were going to be fair. Quote, I've found very few situations where Republicans cheat. They don't control the inner cities the way Democrats do. Maybe if Republicans control the inner cities, they do as much cheating as Democrats. I'm sorry, dead people generally vote for Democrats rather than Republicans. So, you know, the drumbeat's out there.
And again, right. Although one thing I would say about Giuliani is, you know, in the very next breath, he said, you know, when Donald Trump talks about the election being rigged, he's really talking about the media having it in for him. So, you know, he needs to decide which it is. And again, you know, what Giuliani is saying has a very long and ignominious tradition in this country, which is that people use what is ostensibly the cause of common sense, reform to stamp out fraud as an excuse to suppress the vote, and that is a classic example. And it's usually racially tinged. And in this case, talking about Chicago, talking about Philadelphia, there's no question. He's talking about, you know, African-American precincts in large cities. And he's specifically referring to a report of a couple of precincts in Philadelphia that in the last election cycle showed no votes whatsoever for Mitt Romney. Everybody voted for Obama. And there have been extensive attempts to find individual voters who feel that their votes weren't counted for Romney, and the local papers and others have never been able to find any. And conversely, in Utah, you know, an overwhelmingly red state, there were one or two precincts where nobody voted for Obama. So these things do happen. And, you know, my feeling as a reporter is if you find evidence, then act on it. But if there's no evidence, don't say incendiary and irresponsible things. And I think that's what Giuliani has been doing for clear partisan purposes.
Well, here at this radio network, I'm broadcasting from Pacifica. We just had an election, which was rigged, at least in a very petty and small way. You know, they have this crazy system where the voting system dilutes the votes of the popular candidates and boosts the votes of the unpopular candidates. And
right.
Some of the unpopular candidates found ways to get so-called hardship waivers from homeless people and to boost their count. So there is this peculiar impulse out there to cheat. I'm not sure at the end of the day whether the prize is worth it in politics or in running the boards of KPFK and Pacifica.
Right. Well, I do think you deserve, you know, mention for sainthood just for having stayed at KPFK for as long as you have with all the nonsense that's gone on over many years by now.
My days may well be numbered. I thank you for joining us, Andrew Gumbel.
You're very welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Andrew Gumbel, who has worked as an award-winning investigative reporter, a political columnist, and a foreign correspondent for The Guardian, The Independent, Los Angeles Times, The Nation, and The Atlantic. He's the author of several books, including Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed, and Why It Still Matters. And his latest book is Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking to why the succession underway in Thailand following the recent death of the king, who ruled for 70 years, has been delayed for a year. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Gerald Fry, who's an distinguished professor of international and intercultural education at the University of Minnesota. He served as a Peace Corps volunteer in Thailand and went on to do doctoral work in international development education. He has written extensively about Thailand and is currently working on a book called The Thais, the Bamboo, and the Lotus. And he recently published the definitive book on Thailand, A Historical Dictionary of Thailand. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gerald Fry.
Well, thank you for inviting me again. It's a very sad day to be on your program, but it's important to reflect on His Majesty and his legacy.
Well, what is strange about his legacy is that Thailand's crown prince is talking about taking a year off, or, you know, at least spending a year before he assumes the throne. And that in itself is a little strange, is it not?
Well, I think I think it's a very good move on his part to show his deep, deep sincerity to his father. And the last I read was that he was going to at least delay for at least a year, go into mourning for a year in honor of his father. So I think that was a very good move on his part. They had apparently the current military government had offered him the. You know, and by the 1924 succession law is very clear that he, according to that law, will be King Rama the X.
Well, it's a very strange history, though, because in June of 1946 was when the current, well, the king that just died, who ruled for 70 years, he was...
In 70 years, the longest in the world.
Right.
And almost, I think, he almost approached Queen Victoria. She has the long, I think, the lifetime record. I think he was getting close. If he had lasted, he might have, but he's now Queen Elizabeth, I think, will be the longest reigning.
Sure.
Now that, yeah, he has passed. She was coronated, I believe, in 1952.
Right.
And he became king in 1946.
Right.
So 70 years on the throne. Amazing. Amazing long period of being the king of the land.
Well, I was going to say that he became the king on the 9th of June, 1946. But that happened because that the night before, his older brother had been found mysteriously shot to death in his bedroom. And then when he became king, he, of course, accepted. It's a somewhat similar situation to the current situation. But then he went back to Switzerland to continue studying for four more years before returning to be for his coronation. But he was nevertheless officially king while he was in school in Switzerland. So I suppose in that context, the fact that this crown prince is taking a year off is not totally unusual.
No, there's precedent for that. Yeah, they had a regent. And, of course, they had a regent during World War II because King Rama VIII abdicated. So they had a regent when the current king who just passed away, his elder brother was only 9 years old. So they needed a regent. So Dr. Bidi Benomyong was the regent during World War II and played that role very extremely cleverly in terms of Thai bamboo diplomacy.
Right, but this is what I find extraordinary. That Thailand's been run by these military regimes and it's currently run by a military regime, and yet the one time that the military was called upon to defend the country was when the Japanese invaded, and they folded pretty quickly, did they not?
Oh, back in during World War II, as you know, formally they were an ally of Japan, Germany, and Italy. Many people do not realize that. Formally they were an ally, but then Bidi, the regent representing the king, was actually supporting the Allies. This is the incredible Thai bamboo diplomacy. So they were playing both sides at the same time. The prime minister was pro-Japan, and the regent was secretly helping the Allies. It's amazing, bamboo diplomacy.
I understand, but why then does the Thai military have legitimacy when they didn't protect their country when the only time they were called upon it? There's no foreign armies have ever tried to invade Thailand since the Japanese.
Well, I think the then ruler, Pi Bun, was the prime minister, and I think he, and I think the regent as well, even though they were political rivals, they just saw that if Thailand entered the war, they would suffer all the human casualties that happened in Philippines and Singapore. So being a Buddhist peaceful country, they suffered the least in World War II of any country in the Asia-Pacific theater by playing this bamboo diplomacy, one side supporting Japan, one side supporting the Allies. At the same time, the regent supporting one side and the prime minister supporting the other side. Amazing. Thailand's always amazing. That's one of the, I mean, even though this is a very sad day, and this king and his accomplishments are just really totally amazing. He was a true Renaissance man, Ian.
So let's talk further about this, because at the current situation, you do have a very polarized country between the so-called red shirts and the yellow shirts, and Thaksin's people and his sister ruled for a while. He was elected. He's a populist leader who was elected, even though he's a billionaire. He was when we know about that with Donald Trump, right?
right.
He got elected in a landslide.
Populist.
Yeah.
Yes.
He got elected in a landslide, and then they basically they took the government away from him. And now you have the military having taken over again. And my understanding is that the king basically has always sided with the military and the conservative elite against the Thaksin and the populists. So,
I have to. This is one of my disappointments in reading. I've read many editorials in the New York Times and so forth about the legacy of the current king. And as you know, there's a crisis of representation where often we in the West sometimes, to some extent, distort or misrepresent. And actually, in 1973, of course, this is now my sixth decade of working on Thailand. Can you believe that? See how young I am? But it gives me historical perspective that some of these younger writers don't have. And in 1973, there was a big student revolution against the military dictatorship. The king fully supported the students. In 1981, the Young Turks tried to carry out a coup against Prem, who was a former military officer but elected through the democratic process. The king sided with Prem against the Young Turks. In May 1992, General Sujendaj tried to take power. There was people power against him. The king sided with people power. So on those three occasions, the king clearly was on the side of democracy. So this notion that he's always supporting the military is actually historically inaccurate.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the crown prince. And you say, you know, you don't have a problem with him taking a year off to mourn his father's death. Even though he's considered something of a playboy, he lives in Germany. He's been married, I think, three times. Again, sounds a little bit like another billionaire that we're talking about here in the United States. The late king's closest and most influential advisor apparently has expressed reservations about the crown prince's capabilities. So is there anything going on there that we should know about?
Oh, no, the succession law is very clear. According to the 1924 succession law, the next monarch of Thailand, if the crown prince is able and willing to do the job, will be King Rama X. In 1977, a law was passed that does allow Her Royal Highness, Princess Mahajakri Sirinthorn, to become the next queen. But according to the 1924 succession law, and that has not been changed, then the crown prince, whenever he decides, if he decides he's able and wants to do it, then he will become the next monarch. And he has a place in Germany, and he spends quite a bit of time in Germany. But unfortunately, we can't talk openly about it's not appropriate to talk about anything about him, really.
So you can't comment on his competency and the fact that the king's apparently most senior and trusted advisor had in the past questioned whether or not the crown prince was fit for the job.
I think that will be something that, he has to decide himself. Mm-hmm. The crown prince has to decide himself if he's fit for the job and whether he wants to become King Rama the X. And he's, as you probably know, he has talents that many people aren't aware of. He can fly a 737 jet. He was trained at the Royal Military, Royal Air Force Academy in Australia. He can fly F-16. He's involved in some of the fighting against in the Cambodian conflict. So he has some talents that some people aren't aware of.
So you think he's got a pretty bad rap then as a playboy?
Excuse me?
Do you think he got a bad reputation or a rap as a playboy?
Those things I just can't comment on because of the Thailand has a very draconian lese majesty law.
I understand. But are you able to comment on how incredibly wealthy the Thai royal family is?
Oh, that's another matter. Now, there's very great misunderstanding in the West about this.
Right.
So I'm glad you asked about this because, and many people in the West don't understand this. The monarchy, because of all the land owned by the king and the royal family and their assets, I believe they own about 30% of the stock in Siam Commercial Bank and in Siam Cement, two of the leading blue chip companies in Thailand. This wealth is managed by the Crown Property Bureau. I've actually met the gentleman who's the CEO of that. I think it's Dr. Juryu at the moment. Very talented technocrat, very honest, high integrity. And in one of my previous books, I actually had written about the Crown Property Bureau functions as an amalgam of Merrill Lynch and the Ford Foundation. So the Merrill Lynch wing invests the money wisely. Chula Longhorn University, the most elite, prestigious university, sits on royal land. They pay no rent whatsoever. They often charge much lower than the market rate for rent. Then they use the funds for philanthropy. Now, if the princess, Her Royal Highness, gets invited to do something at Harvard, obviously she can find funds to go to Harvard. Or if the Crown Prince has some activities in Germany, he can get funding. But it's a very wealthy institution. And as I say, the one reason I think King Bhumibol was so incredibly popular, he had over 2,000 development projects. He visited every single district, more than 900 districts of Thailand. So he was a really, because of the Crown Property Bureau and their distributing funds for development, was king of the people and seen as a great philanthropist.
Well, just in closing, General Fry, you don't see any problems, and even though there's a military government, it's hardly something that we living in a democracy here can feel good about.
Also, there's unfortunately misunderstanding. As I said, I have a visiting Thai scholar here right now. She just came on last Wednesday. She reluctantly voted for the referendum. She's a red shirt. She reluctantly voted for the referendum. She wasn't voting for military dictatorship. Mm-hmm. She wasn't voting for yellow shirts. What she was voting for, as many other times, was voting for stability. Now, Thailand had about 10 years, Ian, of just out of control instability because of many, many years there of street mobs. I was there once when every major intersection was closed. And then people started, you know, some people in a Buddhist country, it's not good when people start dying. So people were voting, many people were voting not for military, but voting for stability. After the next election, nobody can for sure be sure who will be the next prime minister. In some cases, the military has gone with would support a talented civilian. My dream, I'm not a Thai citizen, so I have no right to select the leader of Thailand, but Dr. Surin would be a really outstanding future leader for Thailand after the election.
Well, General Fry?
Or Dr. Somkit. Sure. Dr. Somkit was a deputy prime minister under Thaksin. So Dr. Somkit, PhD from Northwestern, Dr. Surin, two PhDs from Harvard, they could be very good leaders. And the Senate that will be appointed by this military government, I have many friends in the Thai National Parliament right now appointed by the military. They're not soldiers. They're not Navy. They're not Air Force. They're presidents of universities. They're distinguished intellectuals. So it's not a done deal that the next prime minister may be a military leader. Right. But it could be someone like Dr. Surin or Dr. Somkit.
Well, General Fry, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, good to talk to you.
And again, I've been speaking with General Fry, who's a distinguished professor of international and intercultural education at the University of Minnesota. He served as a Peace Corps volunteer in Thailand and has written extensively about Thailand and is currently working on a book called The Thais, The Bamboo, and The Lotus. And he recently published a definitive book on Thailand, A Historical Dictionary of Thailand. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.